I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Elizabeth Swados was an American writer, composer, musician, and director. In 1978, she received 4 Tony Award nominations for the Best Musical Nominee, Runaways, for its direction, book, score, and choreography. She also wrote musicals that were contemporary, that drew on folk and world music, as well as experimental concepts of theater. A recent album, one that's available on all the streaming platforms, has just been released in physical form, The Liz Swados Project. It is a tribute to her vision and artistry as a composer, lyricist, teacher, and performer. Elizabeth Swados died in 2016 at the age of 64. Hers was a career that was prolific and multifaceted. Joining me now is Chris Kuchel. He is Ms. Swados' longtime musical director, and with Lauren Fitzgerald and Matt Stein, produced this album with 19 tracks, 14 of which are world premiere recordings. I'll ask him about Swados, about her work, as well as the music itself, this album, and the extraordinary luminaries from Broadway today who appear. Star Busby, Sophia Ann Caruso, Damon Downo, Amber Gray, Stephanie Sue, Joe Lampert, Alicia Olakwa, Ashley Perez Flanagan, Grace McLean, and Ali Stroker, with the Bengstons, Heather Christian, Michael R. Jackson, Taylor Mack, Dave Malloy, Shania Taub, and the late Michael Friedman, among others. Chris Kuchel is an orchestrator, arranger, music director, and composer who was most recently the music supervisor, conductor, and orchestrator of the Broadway hit Beetlejuice the Musical. For 10 seasons, he served as the resident music director for the Williamstown Theater Festival. Visit his own website at chriskuchel.com for information. This new album is from Ghostlight Records. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Chris Kuchel. Mr. Kuchel, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. What was Elizabeth Swados? What was she like?
Liz was a truly a one-of-a-kind artist. She did so many things. She was a composer and a writer and a director and a visual artist and... She did basically everything you could imagine, and she had in all of her work, she has a childlike sensibility and excitement, and it's one of the reasons she taught so many people, because she loved young people, and she had just a never-ending curiosity.
And you worked with her, was that right out of college when you first?
I did. Yeah. I did. So I started my career... music directing and orchestrating with Liz. I was actually an acting major in college, and I played the piano on the side, and was hired by NYU to music direct a show, like a senior project that she was working on. And that was 2000.
Uh-huh.
And so that was kind of my first job as music director, and I had no idea what I was doing, and Liz, she believed in me and taught me, and we had a working relationship for about 15 years.
You've had this distinguished career as a music director, but you just mentioned a second ago that you were an acting major.
Yeah.
How do you make the transition from, say, being on stage to under it?
under it, I like that. That's good. I think that, you know, first of all, a lot of the basics of storytelling are true no matter what your discipline is. So the things that you learn as an actor can then translate to your life as a musician. I think, you know, I've always loved theater in a holistic sense. So I knew I wanted to work somehow in theater, but I think it took me some time to find out which was the right path. I also think that it has helped me immensely in my career to understand the language of actors and to be able to talk to them as an actor musician as opposed to a musician,
right.
And sort of speak the same language, and that's always been a very useful tool.
So the skills, the craft that you learned from Swados, that's, as you just said, led to a 20-year career,
uh-huh,
doing great things in the theater. what are the things that you learned early on that you still keep front of mind today as you do your work, or say when you talk to people who want to do what you do, say? I mean, there must be advice that you glean from her that that you keep front of mind now?
Yeah, I think there are two big things. One is the importance of words, both in the meaning of the word, but also just in the sound and musicality of the word, and how much, you know, Liz had an emphasis on the consonants. It was always about the consonants and the sound you were making and the rhythm that the consonants would make. So it's one about clarity and communication, but it's also creating, there's music in that. And so that was, you know, lesson number one, day one, that was the lesson, and that's never left me. And it's a very important element of theater music, but music in general. The other thing is Liz had a kind of a wide palette of music that she liked. She was kind of a student of world music. And so she exposed me to a lot of different things that I would never have encountered. And I think the importance of broadening your musical scope has never been lost on me. You know, so if you're imitating or doing something in the style of, it's important to go to the source and to know that source. Because I think a lot of times what happens is that the narrower your gauge is, if you're then imitating a style, you're kind of imitating a style that somebody already imitated that was imitating something else.
Yeah.
So broadening your horizons is a big lesson.
And what emerges, as you just mentioned, there's a wide variety of inspirations. This unique sound that's essentially her own. I mean, I enjoyed the album a great deal because there's something there, even though it may sound different in many different tracks.
Yeah.
There's something that emerges that's uniquely hers. I mean, I'm trying to put my finger on it as to what that would be. I mean, you work with her for many years. You've produced this album now. Is there something about her work that's uniquely a sound of Suedos, if you will?
There is. But I am sort of in the same boat as you, is that I can't actually describe what that thing is. But it is. It's amazing because you listen to this album that is so varied, and every song is a different performer in a different style,
mm-hmm.
and yet there is a cohesive thing that is purely Liz. And I don't know. I actually don't know a way to describe it. You know, it's lived in. I understand it like emotionally, but it's kind of an amazing thing.
And there are topics in the work that. You know, that are that some people consider dark, you know, racism, murder, mental illness. But through it all, it doesn't lose its hopefulness. Is that the sense that you get as well?
Absolutely. And I think that is sort of ties into Liz's childlike nature and her enthusiasm for life, even though she never did work that was casual or unimportant. She was... You know, she was a child of the '60s and was a radical and a feminist and believed in social justice and for her whole life. And her work was always working towards that. And she also wasn't afraid of demons. She had a lot of demons in her own life that she expressed through her work. But it is amazing that through all of that darkness and all of that heaviness and weight, the hopefulness is never lost, which is really amazing.
And there's a thing, too. I was looking at the tracks and looking at the I guess, where they're from, you know, the different works of hers. Some of them are, you know, 3-4 decades old, yet very timely, very relevant to today, aren't they?
Very relevant, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I think, Liz, you know, it's very common to say that people are ahead of their time. That's a cliched phrase.
Sure.
But I think Liz truly was in the sense that... she saw that the social justice movement was, not that she saw it coming, but she saw the importance of it and focused early on when a lot of the theater world or just art in general wasn't focusing on it. But it was never, it was always genuine with her, and it was never because it was something other people were doing. You know, she really led the way.
So you mentioned earlier the relationship that she had with encouraging young people.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that she had from the beginning. I mean, Runaways is over 40 years old now.
Yeah.
That's something that she always had front of mind, isn't it?
Absolutely. So, yeah. So Runaways is the a show that she wrote at the Public that then moved to Broadway in 1978. And it was sort of actually oddly created in the model of a chorus line. Chorus line, it happened earlier, and then Joe Papp, who was Liz's mentor, who ran the Public Theater, Liz wanted to create a show around runaway teenage kids and young kids, and so she got actual runaway kids, some actors, a mix of people, and did workshops and developed the material, and it was all, there's no story, it's episodic, and it's their individual stories, monologues and scenes and songs. And Liz herself was very young at the time, she was 27, working with, you know, kids from 6 years old to, you know, 18 or 19 years old, some professionals, some who had never stepped foot on a stage. And she never lost that. She's as her entire career was, there was always an element where she was working with kids, either creating work for them or teaching. She taught at NYU for, you know, 30 years or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are a number of songs on this album from Runaways. I guess that's the work that most people will know her from, right? What did that piece, what did that show, what did that mean to her?
I think it was a complicated thing. You know, it was something that was not at all commercial. There was no commercial intention behind it. I mean, it was created at a downtown theater with a bunch of runaway kids. Mm-hmm. You know, the least, like, Broadway thing you could think of. And it became kind of a sensation and, you know, was pushed uptown. And I think she loved it, and I think she loved the kids and was very proud of it. I think that because as what happens in musical theater, a show and a composer lives and dies on cast albums. Cast albums are the things that create a legacy. And unfortunately, a lot of Liz's shows went unrecorded. I mean, most of them. I mean, the only real recording is Runaways. There was a recording of Doonesbury, which is a musical she wrote with Gary Trudeau. But,
yeah,
you know, Runaways is really the album that lives beyond Liz. So I think, you know, it's, that became the thing she was associated with, even though I think, you know, her career was so much more varied than that.
Yeah.
But she also, you know, she was 27 at the time, and she was nominated for 4 Tony Awards by herself for one show in one season, which has never, really been replicated, I think.
Yeah.
So it was an amazing journey for her, I think.
And this album, there are 19 songs on it, 14 are world premiere recordings, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. You had a say, obviously, in what the various performers sang. What was the work in terms of trying to choose what songs to put on the album and which performers to use, say?
They both happened in tandem. I went through songs that I love, that I think are really successful, that are clear and emotional, and I sometimes the songs would lend themselves to a performer. There were other performers that I knew I wanted to have on the album, and then I went from what their style was, and then figured out what would be the best match. So the performer informed the song that way. You know, some of the arrangements were built around the people, like someone like Heather Christian, who sings We Are Not Strangers, which is a song from Runaways, but is vastly different than it is on Runaways. And it really is, you know, we worked together to create this track that is purely Heather Christian and what she sings like, and there are, like, it sounds like 1,000 people singing, and every track is Heather Christian. We just kept layering tracks upon tracks upon tracks. So both informed each other for sure.
And a lot of the contributors to the album, they're people who work in the theater today, big time people as well. Mm-hmm. What did they know of Suedos? And I guess this speaks to her influence on the theater today, right?
That's exactly right. Well, I mean, the goal and the people that we included on the album was that there is, a sort of a generation that has arrived on Broadway or the forefront of the American theater right now, that's creating musical theater that has one foot in mainstream theater and one foot in downtown avant-garde theater. And I'm talking both about performers and writers. And so that was the theme of the people we included. So they're all people like Dave Malloy and Grace McLean and the Banksons and people that are writing, and Michael R. Jackson, and on the forefront of writing new musicals. Mm-hmm. And then performers like Amber Gray and Damon Dono and Ali Stroker, who were part of the downtown sphere before they arrived in Oklahoma or Natasha Pierre or however they were brought uptown. All of the people on the album either were direct students of Liz's or actors in Liz's pieces or part of the world of those people. If you spent time as a young artist in the theater in New York downtown, you knew Liz. You knew someone who worked with Liz. If you went to NYU, you knew Liz. So her legacy is carried through by all of these people that she touched and taught.
Michael Friedman appears on the album. He studied with her. I've read things where he's talked of her influence on him. Mm-hmm. Where's that recording from?
So that is from a concert we did after Liz passed away at Lincoln Center. You know, they have a series called The American Songbook where they celebrate either a composer or a performer. And so we did an evening for Liz, which was kind of the impetus for making the album. Different songs, but the idea of it. And so Michael Friedman was actually Liz's music director right before me. So I met Michael through Liz. Then Michael decided to focus, rightly so, on being a composer. And I worked with Michael as well for many years. And he was able to do the thing that Liz did, which was to take words that are not explicitly lyrical and turn them into music. A lot of his songs are very conversational. His work with the civilians, when they would do interviews, and he would write songs that were verbatim interviews, and his musicality was always shown through. And it's amazing because there's things that should not work, and they always did. And I think that reliance on words is, as I said before, it was the thing Liz taught us. And and it carried through all of his work.
Yeah. And Suedos herself appears on the album. Bird Lament is one of the most captivating things I've ever heard. It's probably one of my favorite things in the album. I don't know. I'll get you to explain it for people listening to this who probably haven't heard it yet.
Sure. It's quite an astounding piece of music. So it is a track from a song cycle that Liz wrote in 1977, I think, called the Nightclub Cantata, like a small cabaret show downtown. And one of the songs was this bird lament that is, there are no words. It's just a single guitar playing an ostinato note, just a single note over and over again. And Liz making a conversation of bird sounds just with herself that is like constantly varied and surprising and not like, like you said, it's not like anything you've ever heard before. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and it stays with you, and then you have to go back to listen to it. I mean, to make sure that it's an actual voice rather than
That's
a bird.
Right. But there's also so much like melancholy and sadness to it. It's really amazing.
Yeah, you get a feeling of what it feels like, or what the bird feels like, if you will.
Completely.
One of the things that made the album enjoyable is that it reminds us of what it's like to be in a room watching performance, be it theater or concerts and the sort. What have these last few months been like for you?
They're hard. I think it's hard on all of us. I mean, we're all doing remote work and Zoom work, and we recorded the album, obviously, before COVID, so it was in October, November, a little bit in January, And it turned out to be the biggest blessing because we were able to mix and work on the mastering while we were all in lockdown, which we could all, you know, keep. We all just kept sending files to each other and sending notes. But that was the, you know, that was like April. So it was a month of, a very busy month of work on this album that was very satisfying. And so that was a good thing. But yeah, it's hard. It's, you know, theater is not meant to exist on a computer or a TV. It's about the connections between people and seeing them there and hearing them sing in front of you and making sounds and hearing the instruments, and all of that is real and live. Even if there are microphones, whatever, it's still there, and that can never be duplicated, you know?
Yeah. You were involved with the Beetlejuice musical.
Right.
I've interviewed Eddie Perfect
for
the album. What was it like working with him?
Eddie is the best. He is just like the greatest guy. He is so nice and funny and warm and so hardworking, and he is so clever and funny, and he just keeps writing out these songs that there are so many jokes packed into these songs, and he's sort of I don't know if he gets the credit that he deserves, because I don't know of another composer who can write that many jokes and songs. You know, he was sort of tireless in Beetlejuice. We had a long development on that show, and there are probably three other full musicals of Beetlejuice that could be made out of all the material that was cut and changed. And but it was a joy from start to finish. It really was. I adore Eddie.
Were you in the pit for that?
I was, yeah. So I was the I'm the orchestrator and choir arranger and music supervisor, and then I also conducted the Broadway run.
So obviously because of COVID, everything stopped.
Yeah.
When things get back to get up and running again, will that show be at the Winter Garden? I guess you all were supposed to be out of there by the spring, weren't you?
We were, yeah. It's a, you know, a complicated situation. We definitely won't be at the Winter Garden because I think the Music Man, they've hung up their marquee, so they're going to move in. The hope is that we will move to another theater, but, you know, everything is so up in the air at the moment. Nothing is sure, nothing is confirmed. We're all hoping that we'll be back, you know, as soon as possible.
I was going to ask you what's next for you, but I guess the best question is when.
That is a good question. The next thing is I'm actually working on a musical version of Hamlet that is every character is written by a different composer.
Okay.
Which is kind of an interesting concept, and so that is being developed through Belmont University for then a commercial development phase after. So, and that's happening kind of right now. We're doing it over Zoom, and so that's this fall. We are doing a production of Beetlejuice in Korea, I think, and that will happen soon because Korea is, the theater is basically up and running there.
Yeah.
So that, I think, will happen in the spring. Yeah, everything else is kind of on hold.
Has it surprised you of the success of Beetlejuice? I mean, this is a show that's going to be produced years and years from now, and you were there for a while, you know, at its development. You talked of its long development.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that generations from now they'll be doing productions of. I mean, do you think about that at all?
Well, I mean, hopefully. That's very kind of you to say, and we all hope so. And it was an interesting journey because, you know, we all, from the very beginning, we all absolutely loved the show and believed in it and believed in the cast and had the most joyous time creating it because it was just, like, the funniest people with this amazing material. And everything we did, we just loved it. And we kind of, you know, in the beginning, we got a little beaten up by some critics, which, you know, puts you back on your heels a little bit. And it took a moment for it to find its feet. It took a moment for it to find its audience. So it was, and which to us was confusing because we thought this is so great. What is, you know?
Yeah.
And then people started to agree with us. And it was really after we did, two things happened. We did the number in the Tony Awards, and the cast album came out, and people, I think, understood the tone of the show and the comedy of it, and that's when it really took off. And we have this, like, rabid fan base that is amazing and still is, like, growing, and so it was really exciting to see something that we all love so much that we, like, sort of started to question, and then to feel, like, validated that we weren't crazy, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's taken a life of its own on social media, on TikTok and the sort, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. TikTok mm-hmm. really, I don't understand TikTok. It was, like, the first time I ever heard the name TikTok because we had an actress who was the cover of Lydia, a young lady named Presley Ryan, who became like a TikTok sensation. She would post a video from her dressing room, and all of a sudden there were 14 million views. Yeah. So it was, it really helped. It helped get our show out there, and especially with that age group, with teenagers and younger people, really latched onto it, which is amazing, because those are the people that you want to be excited about going to see a piece of theater. And it, you know, it can turn their taste for it for their entire lives, you know.
And this goes back to Suedos, doesn't it, in terms of this album is not just a tribute, a memorial even. It really is you think about how prolific and how varied her career was.
Yeah.
It sort of lights a fire under you and want to do more, doesn't it?
For sure. It's like if she can do all of these things, then what are we all doing? Why, you know? And she just never stopped.
Yeah. What did when she thought about her career? I mean, I'm sure you've had conversations with her about this, or maybe not. How did she view it? I mean, she seemed like she was constantly working, that she didn't have time to look back, if you will.
She didn't, and I think that is that is true both in the macro and the micro sense. She didn't have time to look back at her career in general, but also one of the reasons she was so prolific. And I say this both as a positive and a negative, mm-hmm. but she was not an obsessive editor. So she would write something, write a whole show, and then be ready to move on to the next thing. And she wouldn't spend years and years and years perfecting something. So, which I think, there are pluses and minuses to that. So I think there are a lot of shows that she wrote that are unfinished and that could have been finished. But she just couldn't wait to get going on the next thing. And that's why she never stopped.
Indeed. Marvelous lessons are for all of us. I so appreciate your time today, Chris. This is a great album.
Thank you.
Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
The website for more is at chriskuchel.com. Visit Ghostlight Records' website for information on the album, The Liz Suedos Project. It is available on all the streaming platforms, and you can get the physical form through their website. Chris Kuchel joined me on the line from Denver, Colorado, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.